We made this.
Is now Soylent Green is people. My name is Kurt North, and welcome along, and thank you all for joining us again for another season 3 entry. Still in the early part of the season, and this week we are going to be talking about Skull and Bones, which is season 3, episode 6, and this was written by Chip Johansson and Ken Horton. It was directed by Paul Shapiro. And as always, I'm not alone. I have two guests this week. Recurring guest who has been on season 3 before, Chris Knowles, has returned to join me into the fray. Chris, how are you doing, mate? How's the things going?
Going great. Hanging in there. Staying alive.
As many of us are at the moment during the pandemic, the UK, the cases have started to rise again. The schools have just gone back. So it's been interesting. And also joining us is, again, back from season 2, where you were last on Beware of the Dog, is John Kenneth Muir. John, how is it going, mate? How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you back on again. Now, the fact that we've missed a few episodes of season 3, obviously we've done all of season 2 now, and we've got through to the time is now. But what do you make to the beginning of season 3 of the likes of the Innocence and the Exegesis up until this point?
I love the third season. I'm one of those people who thinks, each season has its own virtues and they're worth exploring. I think that the third season gets a sort of bum rap unnecessarily.
Yeah. Chris and I talked about Exegesis and the Innocence, which obviously, is two of the episodes which gets a lot of flack for, you know, the way that they treated the actual plague and things like that. But we talked about the themes of like sort of the daughters and the mothers and obviously Frank and his daughter and things like that. So there's a lot to love in those early parts, and even likes of the end of the world as we know it. I spoke with Adam Chamberlain about that, and how that episode is. Although I'm not in love with that episode, I actually do enjoy it, and I think that, as you say, given season 3 a bit of a wide berth, and actually taking each episode as it is really worthwhile doing. And I think people will get a lot out of that.
Absolutely, I think you have to sort of take it on its own terms. I mean, it's obviously different, but I don't know that substantively it's that different between, it's any more different than the gap between season 1 and season 2. There's a big gap there as well. So.
Yeah, there is. Well, this week we're talking about a particular poignant episode as well, Chris. We're talking about Skull and Bones. What's your first impressions of Skull and Bones? What do you make to it in the season run? Do you particularly like this one?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's pitch black, man. It's dark. It's heavy. It's like heavy metal. Millennium, sort of back to basics, back to the roots, getting, really heavy and getting down to the nitty gritty. I love it.
We'll talk about it in a bit more depth, but there's a lot to love in this episode. There's things that I noticed that went on rewatch, that there's a lot of, like, not callbacks as such, but you can see the things like Chip Johannesson's work in this, and you can see callbacks to almost like the very very first episode and the pilot, and then obviously trying to join the elements of what season 2 was to the way obviously Peter Watts comes into this one, which is an interesting thing in itself. Do you remember seeing this on your first watch? Because you didn't watch this season till later on, did you, Chris? I think it was a few.
No, I didn't watch it till many years later. And, when you talk about callbacks, the thing that I find really interesting is how Johannesson and Horton sort of like, let's undo what we saw in season 2 as far as the Cheryl Andrews character is concerned. I think they were pretty unhappy with the direction she took. And I must say, I mean, I do like season 2 quite a bit, but I think The Hand of St. Sebastian is one of the worst episodes that you know, has ever been associated with the Millennium. And just really, I mean, it was like watching, I don't know, like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon from the 70s. I mean, it was just so weird and so not Millennium. And just the way they sort of revised her character, you're just watching, it's like, why couldn't they just introduce a new character? Why do they have to change this character? And I think that, you know, I think it was a very conscious attempt on Johannesson's part to fix the mistakes, I guess you would say. I mean, you know, turn the clock back a bit and give her a better send-off than, you know, what we remembered her in that just really train wreck episode. So.
Okay. John, what's your general impression of season this episode now, how it fits into the kind of the canvas of all three seasons, really? Because it does a lot within this episode to kind of bridge all three of them.
Right. I mean, I think this is a really important episode continuity wise, because obviously, you know, the push, the drive, the arc of the three seasons, if you're going to try to take it as a whole, it's sort of learning about the Millennium Group and they sort of appear heroic. Then we're sort of not so sure, and we know they're into some bad things, and they're more like a cult. And then we arrive in the third season with them being, you know, fully fledged, you know, villains. And this episode is literally, you know, where the bodies are buried. That it's a piece of it's that piece of the puzzle. What happens when you cross the Millennium Group? You know, you disappear. You know, your bones are, you know, stripped, and we see the it's like flashing forward to the Saw movies in the 2000s. You know, we see the killing floor, and clearly Peter Watts here is at his most malevolent, and he gives his sort of the price of freedom speech, I guess you could say, at the end. I mean, you know, we have a, you know, a stable and safe society. You think that's an accident? You know, basically justifying all the bad behavior, all the murders. You know, literally, these are the Millennium Group's, it's their killing fields. That's literally what we run across on this episode. So I agree that it's extremely dark, but it's also a necessary piece of this puzzle, because the Millennium Group seems to have its tentacles in so many different, I don't know, like weapons systems, you know, like the plague in season two, whatever they're doing here with the radiation, they seem to have their hands in everything. And you have to assume that when people find out, they eliminate them. And sort of now we know what is happening to them.
Yeah, I mean, we also look at the IMDb score on the show as well. And I always find it interesting with season three, because the numbers obviously dwindle with people voting. So it becomes more of a almost like a distilled version of what people feel. This one itself is it's the highest rated of the episodes so far. It's 7.6. 13 years later, before that, got 7.2. And the rest were around 7.2, 7.3, 7.4. So there's a slight uptick with this one. And I think that with, as you say, with the Millennium kind of stuff that's in there, it is harking back to that. And, you know, the kind of mythos that's kind of being built around it and the change. It's interesting that it does uptick on the previous episodes. And obviously with the fact that, you know, we've got Michael Duggan, who's soon to be leaving on the show, and all the behind the scenes thing is really interesting. But I think, yeah, let's dive into the episode, and let's see where it takes us, because there's quite a lot to get into this. I always feel that this episode, for me, even though it's 42 minutes long, it always feels longer. It always feels like it's, you know, a good hour. And I think just with the amount of stuff that's in there. So let's have a look into the episode as in general. The opening starts off, and I think this has the hallmarks of Chip Johannesson all over this, with the there's obviously the scene with the in the highway area, and you've got the bodies being found, or one fragment of bones being found. But then we move into this this other scene where we do find you know, Aerocross's you know, character sitting on the park bench, and with everything going around it. And it, for me, this is why I'm saying it has a vibe. I don't know if Chris, if if you would agree with this or not, but it had the very vibe of The Frenchman, but mangled in with things like obviously what Chip Johannesson's done before, like Force Majeure and things like that. It felt very kind of off kilter with the 90s music element and stuff like that. Did you what did you think to this opening as an opening for Millennium?
Well, I really like the fact that Johannesson's sensibility is very, you know, like you said, it's very off kilter. It's very disorienting. You know, I think that I would have liked a lot more of that. I mean, I wish the whole series had that vibe. I wish every episode had that kind of like, you know, you're on squishy, territory. Your footing is not quite sure. You never really know what's going on. I mean, everything is kind of like a hall of mirrors. I think that sensibility really fits the character and really fits the premise. And I really wish that, they went a little, you know, harder core in that. I wish they went a little deeper into that whole feeling, because I think the problem with Millennium, and I think the struggle that the series had, is that nobody could actually figure out what it was. You know, I don't think that there was, I think there was a lot of confusion in the writer's room. I think that people had their own take on the premise, and they all had a different point of view and what they thought the series should be. And I think that lack of a singular vision, you know, like you had that singular vision of the X-Files, you know, where like everything is filtered through Chris Carter. I mean, you know, you have a lot of great writers and everything, but it's all going to be filtered through his sensibility. And it always had his stamp on it. And I think the problem with Millennium, you know, I mean, there are a lot of problems. You know, people talk about the lack of humor. I really believe that they should have had like Emma Wallace earlier. I mean, like that, the dynamic that we see in the third season, I think they should have set up in the first season. I think that the first season just felt a little drifty, and you never know who anyone is. And the Millennium Group people are all like very generic and interchangeable. I mean, I think that the season three, unfortunately, I mean, you know, I think people had checked out really of Millennium. I mean, the mass audience checked out pretty much halfway through season one. And then you had, you know, you had a strong cult following for season two, but it had very low ratings. And I think by the end of season two, I mean, it was just, you know, people had just checked out. And I think that a lot of the mistakes of the first two seasons, I think, were rectified in the third season. And, you know, like, for instance, you talk about Peter Watts, and like, to me, Peter Watts is not like, he's not a villain. Well, he is a villain, but he's the worst kind of villain. He's the villain who's a true believer. He's a villain who's, you know, who's on a crusade, who believes that he's right, and he knows what's right for the rest of the world, and the rest of the world has to adhere to his dictates. I mean, that's the most dangerous villain of all. So I think that the writers in this episode really do a fantastic job of spelling that out. You know, that you see him like justifying himself, and he does so again at the end of the season. But I love that, you know, when he goes, it's like, you know, you had mentioned that whole thing about, you know, you think it's an accident, or maybe, I'm sorry, John, you know, mentioned that, you know, it's an accident that we have this stable society. And, you know, the thing is too, if you notice that these people hadn't crossed the Millennium Group, per se, they were people who the Millennium Group perceived as like, not even as a threat, but as a potential threat. And that's what makes it so, to me, so believable, because it just shows that cult mentality that, to me, I think is very true to life.
Yeah, I mean, the group itself, so obviously we'll talk about that now, actually, because that was going to be one of the things before we get into talking about Peter and Emma and the like, but and the plot. I mean, if you've got anything to bring to the table, John, with the introduction, feel free to do this after I've asked this question. But the use of the Millennium Group here, because, you know, season one was very much referred to as the serial killer of the week, which, you know, rightly or wrongly, which obviously a lot of us do think was wrongly labelled that. But the actual plot of this is, you know, there isn't an end of the story where, you know, the bad guy gets locked up. The person who we think is the originally, to begin with, in the opening scene is Ed, and there's something not quite right with him. But he inevitably ends up in being something completely different to what you expect. So the focus very much here is on on the Millennium Group. So it's changed the way it's changed here. How do you pass that in from the previous season, and how it switches to this group who are kind of looking after America more than anything else? Because obviously you'd mentioned Hans Sebastian, Chris, but you know, it kind of got a very Christianity kind of aspect, European kind of stuff, and now it's very focused on the Americans and, you know, their protection of their world, and some of this is very pertinent to modern times actually as we speak. But so what do you make to that, the actual retooling here, and how the episode affects that?
You know, to go back to the opening, what I really like about it is that off-kilter sensibility. We see a skull sort of thrown through the air and it becomes a baseball. We see what we think are squirrels speaking, or chipmunks. I'm not sure what they were, but then we sort of we tilt up and see that there are children talking behind the squirrels. And to me, this was just a very important and necessary way to establish the connection between that character and Frank Black. These are both people who have a different kind of vision. They both see things other people don't see. Now, their viewpoints are obviously completely different and manifest differently in terms of style. You know, we get the flashes, things like that with Frank, and we get this weird quasi-whimsical but also sort of quasi-creepy moment in, what is it, McMillan Park in Arlington, where you know, we get a sense of his vision. So I thought actually that was a really great way to start the episode, because it suggests, you know, right after the preamble in Fingus Maine, that this is a person who makes connections and sees the world in unusual ways, which makes him of a mind with Frank, even though the way they do it is different. So I think that was a really clever way to start the episode and to establish that we are in the presence of somebody who can detect, as Frank can detect, that there is something amiss and that the Millennium Group is doing bad things. Now, to get what you were saying about the Millennium Group, you know, in American society, there is a significant portion of the population that sees this weird fusion of Christianity, nationalism, as patriotism, and that other things, other philosophies are not merely different, but wrong, subversive, whatever you want to say. And clearly what we are getting at with the Millennium Group is it is this weird combination. It's the same weird combination. It's this Christianity, which doesn't actually seem to adhere to anything that's written in the Bible, but it's a professing of Christianity, and then it's this weird militant group that sees itself as patriotic when in fact they're using religion, nationalism, whatever, to cover absolutely, you know, the murders of innocent people, and certainly if you look at where we went as a culture in the 2000s, where we said basically to the world, it's okay for us to launch preemptive wars against people. If you're even, you know, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. And if we think you're going to do something, listen, you know, you don't have to attack us. We're going to attack you first. This idea of it's a weird mirror. It's a weird twisted reflection of the idea of American exceptionalism, which is that basically whatever we do, we're a priori right. That's it. I mean, that's clearly the Millennium Group's approach. That, and really, when you look at it, the group is positioned in the highest places in the American government, in law enforcement, things like that. And again, I mean, we've seen that. We've seen that there are these people in high places who have this mingled view of patriotism, which includes, you know, American Christianity in a very weird branch, and this sort of nationalism patriotism. So, I mean, that was a long answer, but I think you're right on the money with what you're saying. There's this weird, you know, the Millennium Group is a force in American society pulling the strings, and certainly we have seen that that's not entirely fictional. That we've seen there are individuals and groups like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, another thing as well on top of that, which kind of jumped out to me in these last two watches, was the kind of plot with the Cynthia Padgett stuff. So when we see Ed's writings from McLaren's going through it with Frank, and I'll ask a question about this shortly with regards to Frank and Emma. But the plot kind of goes down the line of that, you know, this guy has seen the first murder. And he became so obsessed with it, as you say, I didn't think about the actual top of the hour there with being, you know, his kind of vision. It just didn't click with me, which it totally makes sense now you say it. But this use of, you know, facts being out there as well, which seems to be, you know, almost foretelling what we've had in the last few years. Because he talks about everything that he has found, everything he has done has been in the public domain. I think they say something to that effect at some point. You know, the professors have been in newspapers, that he's linked words with names and that's how Emma eventually gets to find out where the house is at the very end as well. It's like all the information is available to you. And then there's also this feeling, Chris, of this kind of like thing of, you know, all that information is available to you. And especially what Peter says during the episode as well, with the fact that Frank is taking it as and is almost like repeating it out and making his own narrative out of it, which I find really interesting, especially in these times, that's Peter's argument against Frank and is trying to change Emma in that way. And we'll get into more of that with that conversation with Emma and Peter in a second. But it is really interesting that aspect of, you know, this you know, the truth is literally written on the paper and you can get that. It's just about joining the dots.
Well, that's very true to life. You know, and what happens is that people like, oh, I just want to give a shout out because I love that actor, Ari Gross, who plays Ed. Thank you. And I always thought he should have been in the X-Files, and he didn't show up in the X-Files until like season 8. And it wasn't even that big a role. I was always kind of curious because he just seemed like such a perfect actor for an X-Files episode, you know, and I think he's used very well here. I think he has a sort of inherent personality that I think, you know, you sort of sense it in him as an actor, but I think they really draw it out here, and I think they do a great job. Yeah, I mean, he unfortunately he notices that bad things are going on. Most people don't notice, they don't pay attention, and he had the unfortunate bad luck to have witnessed one of these executions, and then he realizes, oh wait, you know, the world that I'm told that I live in is not actually the world that I live in, because these things happen in the shadows. And then he goes and he finds that they're everywhere, and you see him sort of develop a kind of, you know, a graphomania. As I don't know if Frank uses that exact term, but, you know, Frank sort of points that out, that, you know, the obsession with cataloging these events has become so overwhelming that, you know, his writing is almost barely legible or, you know, even visible. So, yeah, a great character, a great use of that actor, you know, very true to life, you know, just really well done. I mean, like I said, I love this episode. I think that it's a real shame that people, you know, more people. I think I saw like 182 people had voted on this on IMDb, and you just think like, wow, that's, you know, there are like indie movies that nobody, you know, that have never been shown anywhere that get more votes than that. You know, it's really kind of shocking.
Yeah,
but it just shows like, you know, how far the stock on this series have fallen. And I think it's really unfortunate, because I think they were doing very good work in the third season. And I almost think that, because they knew that the spotlight was off, that, you know, all these kind of weird books and weird internet postings and all this kind of really deep, deep, dark, fringy kind of material that, you know, everybody had been sort of storing up around the 1013 bungalow on the Fox lot there, you know, really came up, because, you know, this whole season, there's some really heavy stuff that you just, I you know, I still can't believe made it onto television. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're right with that. I mean, we're only just touching the surface. Obviously, we've had a few episodes here and there about so far. But when we get into later into the season, I'm really looking forward to towards the back end of season three, because it's it does get a lot stronger. And then this one for me, I would actually put this put this up there with some of the best of Millennium could handle. I mean, something I didn't do was for ratings. I mean, John, what would you rate this out of 10 for you?
Oh yeah, this would be one of the top episodes of the series as a whole. I would definitely put it up in the range, 8 to 10 as far as if I were scoring it out of 10. There's no reason it doesn't rank with the very best of the show. It's just I think. It's funny. We're sort of the product of our own biases and things like that. And so for the, Chris made a good point there. The audience was smaller this season. For the audience that was there, they're upset that Catherine is no longer on the show. You know what I'm saying? They're investing in like negative arguments and not seeing what is there and how positive it is. And Chris earlier said this, and I couldn't agree with him more, is that having Emma, the series really would have worked, I think, even better had she been Frank's partner from the start. You see in the first two seasons, which are, obviously brilliant in different ways, but they have a hard time finding a sort of female co-lead with Frank. I mean, Catherine is cast to the sideline because she's at home. Right. And Laura Means being the psychic, she's almost too flaky for him in some sense, or the balance was wrong or something. But the idea here, which is and fits in thematically with the season, and we see it here as well, is Emma is looking for who's the father figure? Who is the person she should believe and trust and can guide her? Who is her mentor? Right. And we have some competitors for that. We know later on what's happening with her own father who's sick, right? But then we have, okay, on one side we have Frank, and then on another we have Watts, right? So which way does she go? I mean, there's a real interesting conflict for that character. And she works so well in the show because she's a strong, optimistic, positive force, but yet because she's young and new, she's looking around to see what the lay of the land is, who's telling me the truth. And I just think that dynamic works extremely well with Lance Henriksen, whereas the wife character being sidelined didn't particularly work that well. Some episodes it did. I mean, she didn't have much to do. She was a great character, and what she had was great, but she was sidelined so much. And Laura Means, again, somehow the balance wasn't right there. So I think that, I think this episode is terrific and it proves what Millennium can do. But most of the people who are still watching were already like, you got two strikes down, right? Catherine, his wife's gone. The Yellow House is gone. You switched coasts. What now? We're getting partners. What is this, an X-Files ripoff? I mean, if you look at the surface of it all, it's like, yeah, if you're just looking at that, you're like, okay, they're on their last leg here. But if you actually look at what's there and sort of move those biases aside, it's a pretty great episode.
Yeah, I just want to weigh in here just real quick. When I had done my first Millennium show with Darren, I guess it was on The Thin White Line. I know people are just gonna probably write me off for good when I say this, but Emma Hollis is my favorite character on the series. I love the actress Clea Scott. I think she nailed the character from the jump. I mean, from the first time that character appears on screen, you get a sense of who she is and what she's going to do. And I mean, it's just, she just got the character so brilliantly and she just embodied it so well. And I just think it was such a, I think, like I said, you needed that character from the jump. You needed a character who would balance out, Frank's point of view. I mean, John had mentioned with Laura Means. I mean, Laura Means was just like Frank on an overdose of Adderall. I mean, she's just like an extreme version of Frank. There's no balance there. It's one of my, I love X-Files season 8, but one of the problems that I have is that you notice that Doggett plays better with Mulder than he does with Scully. And why is that? Because Doggett and Scully are just too similar. They have like, they're both very serious and kind of slightly dark characters with, you know, broody, kind of moody characters. They're too similar. It's like there's no balance there. And I think what makes Emma Hollis work so well, and the reason why I just think she's a great character, even though I don't think the material was always up to the standard in this season, is she's just a great character that the show needed from the jump.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm right in this, and forgive me if I'm putting words into your mouth, but a couple of things that John mentioned there was the fact about the X-Files light, and if it had the confidence to go down that route, then, you know, it didn't necessarily need to worry about that because of the dynamic that they're doing. But obviously, it's a 10-13 production; it's going to get referenced to that. And speaking about the Emma thing, I mean, if you look at the episodes that we've had so far, and this will lead into exactly where we are now, is that you know, in The Innocents, she's very much like, you know, like focusing all her attentions on Frank and being, I've nicknamed her the Terrier during these episodes, because she just literally like is constantly there and actually is a good pull to Frank to get him out of the zone that he's in. She just keeps biting at the bit and going to the hospital and all kinds. And then you've got the end of the world as we know it, where she's taking things on board and Barry Baldwin saying one thing and she's involved in there. And she almost word for word says something that was said in the previous episode. We've got the closure episode, which is pretty much about her. And then obviously 13 years later, which goes to kind of build her character up a little bit. And then we come to here. And I think it was a very, very wise choice in this episode, was that we kept Frank away and we kept them separate. Now, that sometimes can be, you know, a black mark, especially in the X-Files. People have often said, you know, well, Mulder and Scully are just doing, Mulder's off going out on a jolly while Scully's in hospital, or Scully's doing the science and Mulder's going off running around and doing what he needs to do. But in this one, it's done for a particular reason, and that's to get Peter and Emma to get that balance. And I think that for me, and we'll talk about this now, is the stuff that Peter kind of is almost like concerned, enamored, ambivalent about the whole situation, because he comes into this world and he's, you know, he's trying to protect his secret or their secret, and he seems impressed with Emma, but at the same time concerned that she's going too far and will reveal their secrets. And I think that keeping Frank away from that and keeping Frank's anger like he was in The Innocents is a really good plot point. And I think this episode especially works well because the two are apart. I don't know what you think to that, John, and how the Peter and Emma relationship works here.
No, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. I mean, the thing is that Emma here gets the chance to prove how strong she is. You know, if you have somebody who's with you, you know, and obviously I love Frank. He's an amazing character. But I mean, you know, he's talking about conspiracy. This group is doing things. You know, you have that with you all the time. You're not being sort of tested on your own. She has to go up there and stand up to this. She's got to decide, like the viewer has to decide, you know, is this right? Is this wrong? What am I seeing here? And she clearly makes that decision. And if Frank were with her the whole time, again, because of the sort of, I don't know if you want to say age, experience, wisdom differential there, you would feel like she was almost sort of being dragged along by his perceptions, by splitting them up, by sending them off on different stories. She has to kind of come to these conclusions on her own. I mean, of course, she's in communication with Frank. He's sending her the little email that says they killed her, whatever, you know, it pops up on her screen, you know, like a little yellow post-it on her, you know, email there, but still she's having to contend with all the people there and deal with the ideas herself, which just makes the character that much more established, that stronger. So I think that's great. And in terms of her relationship with Peter, I mean, we know where this is going to go. We know what happens, and it's tragic and it's heartbreaking, sort of the decision she has to make, though I think we all understand ultimately why she makes it at the end of the series. But she's choosing between mentors and ways. And I mean, it's fascinating because it's clear that she's a person like I hope most of us would be horrified by what happens in Fingus Maine and what the group does. And, you know, they're standing there watching Homer Petty's house be destroyed. I mean, destroying evidence right in front of you. Right. She's horrified by that. But at the end, she has to sort of throw in her lot with them because that's the only thing that she can do for her family. Yeah. You know, it's a great kind of character arc, and it just builds her up here to be a strong moral person, I think. So I mean, I love it. But, you know, again, we see she's going to be torn between these two more experienced mentors or men, however you want to put it.
Yeah, I mean, what I particularly like about this is I think obviously Clea Scott, as Chris says, you know, the fact that she's an amazing actress, but I also think that you know, Terry O'Quinn is an amazing actor as well, and but they both play this awkwardness throughout this episode, and especially Emma, because you're getting the vibe that, you know, Frank has gone on about this, and Peter's trying to break down that conversation to, you know, the fact that Frank has been around the block. He's not thinking right. He's making his own, you know, is making his own enigmas in some ways. He's just recounting stuff that may well happen or has happened and isn't the truth as such. But I think Terry O'Quinn, if I move to Terry O'Quinn a little bit with his acting in this episode, Chris, is that there's moments in the episode, and the look on his face when, you know, a piece of evidence is brought to him, the skull is being cracked open, and, you know, he kind of has this stare. That when Emma brings more the Cynthia Padgett picture, and he also walks away, and Barry Baldwin comes and said, you know, yeah, what have we done to piss him off, and stuff like that, and just that build that, and then obviously the ominous thing of when, you know, she does get that post-it note, that email, and she goes looking for the other body, looking for the other skull, and you get, which I think is a really good part of the episode. I think the direction needs to be commended here, because there's a couple of God scenes, a couple of scenes where we're looking overhead. But there's also this scene as well, where there's an ominous, there's Max Knowles music building up. You're feeling the tension. You know, if you haven't really met Peter Watts before, you know, you might get to that feeling of, is she going to try and kill him or kill her or whatever? But I think that Terry O'Quinn does a marvelous job of like doing those off screen. Even if you focused on Emma, there's those little bits that if you watch Terry O'Quinn, it's amazing to watch, and you can see, you know, the internal workings of both him and Emma's thinking. And I think that both of them together works really well.
Well, one of the things I keep banging on about with 1013 in general is point of view storytelling. Mm. So what you really need to establish whenever you're watching an episode of 1013 is who is telling the story here. You know, from whose point of view are you witnessing the story? And, you know, this is something that Chris Carter was always just like hammering and hammering and hammering into his writers. So I think what happens is when we're up in Maine, you know, we're seeing the story being told from, this is all Emma's point of view.
Yeah.
And when she is depicting Peter Watts as being this very sinister character who's just snooping around and, you know, spying on everybody. And, you know, he's really keeping an eye on Emma because he's afraid that she's going to learn the truth and all this kind of stuff. That's Emma's point of view. And I think what happens we're seeing Emma's point of view when, you know, she goes to the PD house and she sees all this horror and, you know, all the, you know, the bodies being disposed of and all this kind of stuff. But I think once Peter enters the scene, we're seeing the story from Peter's view. I think that, you know, when he comes in and sort of reels off this whole soliloquy, I think that is his point of view. The point of view of the story has shifted to him, because he sees himself as a heroic figure. He sees himself as a self-sacrificing figure, and he sees, you know, the Millennium Group as the people who are making, you know, the brutally hard decisions to keep everyone else safe. You know, it's like the old Spock thing. You know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. So I think that's very much what we're seeing here. And, you know, I would say that Frank's point of view is almost just entirely absent from this episode. And maybe it should be, you know, I mean, maybe we need to see Frank in action from other people's point of view. And people had complained about that and said, you know, Frank just seems to be incidental. And people had even made the same complaints about The X-Files, that it just seems to be like there were certain episodes where Mulder and Scully just kind of wandering through the story, not really affecting anything. And I think, you know, you need to do that, because you can, if constantly seeing the story from the protagonist's point of view, you're not getting the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. So, John, so just going back to the thing on the Peter thing as well, is that he goes through a number of different tacks as well, because he starts off by, you know, being impressed by her. Then, you know, because he immediately goes to Barry Baldwin at the start anyway. And then he kind of like tries to confront her, saying, you've got a bad impression about me. Then he kind of adopts the, we've got evidence here of us being real, and do you really want to contact the grieving widows and husbands and whatever? So she goes and looks for the newspaper clipping, which, you know, psychologically she's probably been manipulated in that way. And then the kind of the change in tact again, because he kind of like he can't go any further. He has to like confront her, and then obviously as Chris has said there, when we get to that final scene where, you know, it is very much like this is who they are now. But it is interesting how he's tried throughout this episode various different things to kind of prod Emma's character. What did you make to that?
Yeah, I think he's circling her, trying to figure out what characteristic of hers that he can use or manipulate. It's pretty clear how he can manipulate Baldwin, Outer Bridge's character, that, you know, this is a guy who you flatter him. Wow, what an amazing job you did on those airline remains you found. You know, you flatter him, you play to his ambition, and he's not going to rock the boat. And it's like, dude, why is a Millennium Group guy running your investigation here in Maine? Because Peter walks in and out of there like he's running the place. And then he goes to Emma and he's sort of circling her, trying to figure out what's the angle that I play on her to manipulate her. And I think what he ultimately realizes is there's no angle that he can use on her except that price of freedom speech, because that's actually what he believes. And if we go back to what Chris said about that becoming Peter's point of Watt's point of view, then that's what is that all about. I mean, he's genuine about that. He's not being cynical. I mean, he's not a cynical person. He believes this. This is, it's not an accident, you know, that we're a stable society. Sacrifices have to be made, you know, and I think at the end, what he's realizing is that, you know, she's sort of a true blue person. That she probably believes in the same kind of ideals that he does. And he sees this not as a betrayal of American ideals, but as like the highest point of them. Look what I'm willing to do to preserve my family, my country, my communities. And I think he's thinking, if he's going to reach her in any way, that it's going to be on that, which he thinks is like true blue, but which she, I mean, you know, the ironic thing is he's saying this to her literally as an excavator or whatever it is like, you know, destroying evidence right in front of them, you know. And so how do you hold those two thoughts at once? I'm doing what's right for, you know, society, for everybody. And yet at the same time, I'm like going against, you know, the law, you know. So it's very interesting. But I think he's simply trying to figure out how he gets to her. And of course, he later finds out what her weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what's a genius part of this episode and the episodes that follow it. There's also there's aspects here as well where Emma's broken down. Emma's fairly idealistic. I mean, no, she had that trip to Vancouver for the previous episode or later episode, isn't it, in Human Essence. She takes a trip out there. And, but she's very kind of idealistic at this point, but she doesn't know where to turn in this episode. I mean, it's very telling that, you know, that she's shown this. And as you say, Peter's ideals come out here, and she's shown this. And then at the end of the episode, she's like, there was nothing we can do. And does it really matter? And Frank's retort is, well, yes, it does. And I think that, Frank, as you say, Chris, is on the periphery with this, but it is interesting to see that, you know, it's almost like a breakdown in Emma's character to at least try and find what her weakness is. And as John said there, it kind of, you know, it eventually comes down to family at the end of the day, once we get further down the line. We haven't really talked much about Frank just yet, because obviously there's another side to this story, which is what we're saying about the McLaren side. And, What did you make to the Frank story with regards to Ed? I mean, we've talked about Ed and his kind of vision, kind of quest, kind of thing that's happened in there, and obviously we've got Mobius kind of wandering around the streets as well, who's appearing since last appearance was The Innocents. I'm not actually, he may well have appeared somewhere else, but. What I particularly like within these scenes is that there's almost an element of Frank when he does capture Ed, and he's going through the apartment. He gets all the profile, right? You know, it's a writer, et cetera, et cetera. And then he sits in the chair. And I always see that as like he's trying to get inside the head of a killer, but he can't obviously do that because he isn't one. But what did you make to Frank's investigation from that side, from that element of the McLaren, the writing, and the actual the discussions with Ed and the fact of obviously bringing in Cheryl Andrews?
Well, I love that because that scene that you said, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So we have this whole directive coming from the top, 10-13, of like we need to establish point of view. And that's what Frank is doing. You know, Frank is literally putting himself into another person's point of view, and which he does, of course, throughout the entire series. I mean, it's almost like the point of him, right? Yeah. The point of Frank is to put himself, to see the world through other people's eyes. And, one of the things that we have as human beings is that, there's the whole kill the messenger thing where it's like if somebody's telling you bad news, you believe that that person's responsible for it. So I think that, we see with McLaren and everything that, he sees like, this is a bad guy. This is, and Frank's like, no, cool your jets there. Slow your roll. I mean, we're going to look at this through a different perspective. And, one thing I do have to say is that, I hate that Mobius character. I just, what is he? The character was never well defined. It was, you have this great actor, Bob Wilde, who's just got that great face, and you saw him pop up. I mean, as early as, Little Green Men, I guess. I mean, probably even earlier. I mean, he's a guy who'd always just been like, doing bit parts around the X-Files and so on. What is that character? This character is just like he's just a waste of space, just like all purpose bad guy, He's almost like, there was a great, character in the X-Files, the gray haired man. He was in, Memento Mori and, some other episodes. He's also in, Herrenvoke and so on. And, he was a malevolent character. Whenever he showed up, which wasn't very often, you knew that trouble was on the way. And I think they were trying to do that with that other character. But just the way he shows up in 7 and 1, and I got to tell you, if either one of you can explain to me what the hell 7 and 1 is about, I would appreciate it because I have no idea what that friggin' story is supposed to be about. It doesn't make a lick of sense to me. But he's like a shapeshifter and shut up. It's just terrible character. So that to me is like the only, that's like the only real, floater in the pool. As far as this, it's something you can pretty much safely ignore. But again, I thought Ari Gross was so perfect. And I'll tell you something, if this series had gone on, I would have liked to have seen more of his character. I think he would have been sort of like a good, Max Fennig is sort of like the more extreme version of Mulder,
Yeah.
I think he would have been like, he's the more extreme version of Frank, I think that's a good, good character to play. Unfortunately, the X-Files always had an issue with continuity and always had an issue with bringing people back and recurring characters, because they were trying to kill them off as quickly as possible. I never understood that whole mentality, but it's all hindsight. But that's a great scene. I love Andy McLaren. I thought he was that's another guy who'd been kicking around since the first scene of the X-Files pilot, right? Stephen Miller, great actor.
Yeah.
Great counterpart to Frank. Not a heavy like you'd see in, like an assistant director who's just sort of like this big teddy bear, but, he's got teeth too. So, like I said, I just so much in this season I love that it really breaks my heart that it just got ignored.
Yeah. So John, so what did you think to that side of the argument? I mean, especially Mobius, I agree, Chris, actually with that. I thought that he would return at some point because it felt like, the fact that he was sending the letters on at the very end, kind of like typical 10-13, it might not ever get picked up again. But what did you make to the this side of the story, this kind of almost like B plot, really?
I really like what Chris said about about the Ed character. I think it would have been great to see him and him being a more extreme version of Frank. I think that's a really good insight. Now, for Mobius, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. I'm going to say this. I'm going to say there are two things that I consider when I see Mobius, why I think he does work when he appears. Is one is that you have to assume any group that's pulling all this crap, this cult or whatever, there's always somebody going to be watching someone like Peter. There's and actually, Watts kind of proves this, and we know what his fate is at the end. Watts believes he's doing the right thing, and from some perspective, he at least believes he's moral. From his point of view, he's moral. So you've got to know the group is worried about him. You've got to know the group is watching him. So of course they send this guy, Mobius, to watch him as well as watch everybody else, because there's always going to be someone in the group watching a person like that, because they think, how are we going to, you know, what if Peter, you know, goes off the reservation, so to speak? What if Watts doesn't do what we want him to do? And again,
wait, he does, doesn't he? In the time is now. So it's always been a question mark on, and I think you're lining a headcanon for me here, but the fact that he disappears at the end of The Time Is Now, or right, the one before it, and then all of a sudden Mobius seems to be his partner for some reason, and I can see that, right. I can see that fitting in quite well, really.
And then the other thing, and please bear me out on this, is that, you know, the Millennium is in some sense a meditation on what evil is. And of course, when it started, it wasn't like the monsters are outside, the monsters are inside us, it's the serial killers. But it very soon went beyond that. As soon as you get episodes like Lamentation, you have, you know, characters who are, you know, for lack of a better word, being angels and demons, you're now adding another interpretation of evil. So why is Mobius a shapeshifter? Because it's like, no, it's the wholeness of evil. It's the evilness. It is human evil represented by the Millennium Group, and it's probably being influenced by this other voice of evil, which, you know, we're talking about, what was it? I can't remember the exact words. Power, principality, dominion.
Yeah, that, power, principality, yeah, thrones, and dominion.
Right, right. Okay. So that episode established a whole hierarchy outside of us in the Millennium Universe that is influencing human actions and human behaviors. So Mobius, in addition to being this enforcer who's going to watch people like Watts, he is this other evil there in the presence of the human evil. Now, the great thing about Millennium is it doesn't say, you know, the group did this because the devil made them do it. You know, it doesn't say anything like that, but it's the idea of this wholeness, this oneness of evil, that there's the human aspect, and then there's this also this other aspect, because again, out of nowhere, he's a shapeshifter. Okay, so he's not human. He's not human. We find that out towards the very end of the series. So he's a representation of that other branch of evil. So, I mean, I think if you look at it in that way, it works. If you look at those two things. So, I mean, I get it, because it's intimated, but never given any kind of voice, you know, as far as specifics. But I mean, I actually kind of like it that way, because I think it would have been crappy to say, you know, the devil is influencing the Millennium Group, and here he is. But I mean, that, what else are we to make of that character?
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, okay. So I mean, I you know, again, just to play literally devil's advocate, that's what she, so I mean, that part of the episode doesn't bother me. In some ways, I think it's actually kind of elegant that he's there, and that he keeps showing up in these very minor parts. Because again, we have that balance between the different kinds of evil. And if you look at the various episodes of Millennium, you can see, well, that thread actually goes through a lot more episodes maybe than we see. And maybe Mobius is the way that thread is being carried forward, you know, through this part of the series run.
Food for thought. There's a couple of things as well. I mean, I think I've pretty much covered most things. I mean, Cheryl Andrews, I can't remember, John, if you had your comment on Cheryl Andrews. So I can't remember which way around I did it now. But what did you make to her inclusion in this episode then?
Well, you know, of course, the first thing I think is, well, this is like the world's worst continuity error. Why on earth would you pick this character? But, you know, Chris made it seem like it very much made sense. You know, it's like, yeah, let's rewrite and give her a better ending, you know, than what she got in that other episode, if you didn't like that other episode. I think it is important that we see somebody, a familiar face, so that we put you know, a familiar face on what the Millennium Group is doing.
Yeah.
But I don't know that she was the right familiar face to put on it because, I mean, going back to what my memory is, I mean, she kind of showed, I don't say true colors, but she showed, let's say, different colors. She, you know, she was doing bad things in the second season. So it's like, maybe, you know, if that other episode weren't there, we'd have a lot more sympathy for her in this episode. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. So to me, it's kind of a glaring hole in the episode. I almost wish there had been somebody else that they could have put in that role who we had some attachment to. Maybe it goes back to this idea of not always bringing back supporting characters, and their stable of supporting characters who were still alive was limited. Yeah. But I mean, we need to identify with the person who went through this, who in the course of doing their job came across something which could prove dangerous to the Millennium Group, and so they were executed for it. You know, that's we want to feel for that person. We want to, you know, and I mean, we do, we still do, but you know, there's that question in Cheryl's past, right? So yeah. I don't know. So I don't know if that element works as well as it should work, I guess.
No, I mean, I tentatively would say I could some ways make it work, but it's very, very ropey. But the because obviously she's having in the Henderson Saint Sebastian, there's that internal war, which you could later on bring in the Owls and Roosters and the various different elements in the group, and whether or not that formed any kind of thing after she got arrested in the first place. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think Chris hit the nail on the head earlier when you've got varying degrees of characters that have appeared, you know, but they've either been microwaved as in Mike, early in the season. And then you've got other characters, which, you know, you think about when the opening hero shot of the beginning and the end, where they come through the airport and there's like, you know, this grandiose kind of entrance, and you know, the Millennium Group are here, and you know, Frank's is at a low ebb and needs help and stuff like that, and there's a couple of people in there you could use, but they're instantly forgettable. And Cheryl Andrews, unfortunately, is played by CCH Pounder, who's you know, is a memorable actress, so right. it's I can see why. And I think, you know, ideally you would like to have had someone else, but they're just the way that the previous characters have been dealt with, and you know, they've been, you know, basically cardboard cutouts in a lot of ways, and just to develop some exposition, and half the time it's Peter Watts giving that. So I can see why there's been that issue, and it is interesting. I mean, there's two things that fall in. I mean, it's the kind of narrative things. I don't tend to pick on narrative things really, but there's you alluded to it, John, in the first instance. So I'll ask Chris this, but the fact that the first Cynthia Padgett is infected with something, and then the radiation is another thing that they're trying to hide. That they seem to be, you know, it's an abstract. There's abstract reasons for these people being buried, and you know, and X-Files has this as well. You know, in many different forms, you know, from Colony and Endgame to the film to, you know, or Anasazi and that trilogy of things being buried underground and coming up to the surface, and this is obviously the same kind of thing. But this abstract thing of, you know, they found something about this radiation or this infection and stuff. What do you make to that? I mean, there's enough there that's not, it doesn't actually physically say anything about it, but it does allude to something. What the Millennium Group are doing behind the scenes?
Well, I think it just alludes to like secret government experiments. You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
That's simple. You know, I mean, who else has access to radiation? You know, it's not something you can, like, I can't go down the store and buy some radiation. You know, it's yeah. it's something that is pretty, you know, it's kept under lock and key. So I think that, you know, some of these things, there might be a lot more poetic license going on that I know a lot of, you know, your real train spottery kind of fans, they get given, they go crazy about the stuff, and I don't necessarily blame them. You know, I mean, it can take you out of the story, but I think in a lot of these cases, it's just, you know, it almost seems like a lot of these details are chosen, you know, like for the poetry of them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. So that effectively, I think we've covered everything apart from maybe the end scene. We very briefly talked about the end scene during our conversations, but there was the, you know, we get to Petty's house, And the music choice is interesting in itself with Love Hurts. Chris, do you want to quickly just to give you a thought on the final element before we get to see Peter talk to Emma? So the actual events in the house.
Well, that's a 10-13 trope, you know. I mean, the whole take the nostalgic 70s song, sometimes syrupy, and can use it to contrast with the horrifying, you know, death and carnage that's going on. It's they did the same thing in Thin White Line with How Deep Is Your Love, right? And the Bee Gees song. So I think that's, you know, that's a trope that the 10-13 have used for a long time. I think it goes back originally to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when the boy is sort of being menaced by these alien spaceships flying around, and then there's something like, I don't know, like Pop Goes the Weasel or some kind of like, you know, kiddie record playing on a loop, you know. I think that might be where that comes from. But, you know, it's to sort of set up an ironic counterpoint to the carnage and grizzle that you're going to experience. But it's just, it's such a great song. It's so dramatic. It's so florid, you know. That version, that's the version by Nazareth. I believe it's an Everly Brothers song, but it really, it's so over the top emotionally that I think it really sets the stage.
Yeah, I mean, the way I read it, I don't know if John, if you would agree with this, but the way I read that song, obviously that Petty's having to do something for, it again goes back to the Peter thing for the greater good, and the fact that his love of like protecting the Millennium Group as such is the fact that, you know, but he's having to do these horrible, horrible things, and he's based at that house, and obviously it was the perfect place to hide the bodies, and I think that's the way it grasped me, was the choice of song was for that reason.
Absolutely. I was going to say, you know, it is absolutely ironic for sure, but Love Hurts. I mean, what are we talking about here? The Millennium Group, boy, they sure hate having to kill these people, but, you know, Love Hurts. You got to do it. You got to do your job because you're protecting your country. And yeah, it hurts. It hurts. Yeah, right. You know, I remember Love Hurts was used sometime later in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 in regards to family. And the Myers family, Lori and Michael and the mom and stuff. But I mean, it's literally whenever it's used, it's the same thing. It's like, yeah, love does hurt, right? And so now we're asking, so what are we saying in terms of Millennium Group here, right? Yeah. What are we talking about in terms of Peter? What are we talking about in terms of Homer? It's exactly what you said. It hurts me that we have to do this, and it's hurting you too, as I cut you apart on this table we see here, right? And then I have to clean you up and boil you in acid in this bloody bathtub. Yes, it's hurting me and it's hurting you, but we have to do it because, you know, free and stable societies, they're not accidents. So, yeah. I mean, boom, puts a point right on it.
Yeah, it does. So that's all I've got. So, Chris, do you want to bring anything up before we have a look on the mailbag?
Just watch it. Great episode, great television. And I think it's a nice through line with what you would call sort of the mythology episodes in this season. You know, it's a really nice companion piece to Collateral Damage, because both of them, you know, they show these marginal characters that people would sort of dismiss as wackos and tinfoil hat nutcases, and actually the people who have experienced horror, and you know, they're not necessarily able to communicate that cogently, which, you know, leads to the marginalization. But I think those two episodes make a nice companion piece if you want sort of like a unbelievably depressing mini movie to watch.
Fantastic. And John, I've got just one question for you, and then finally as well, it's anything you want to bring up, because I haven't asked you this, but what do you make to one, Barry Baldwin's character, and Andy McLaren, as both in the episodes we've seen so far, but obviously in the whole run as well? So what do you think to those two characters that they've also brought into the show?
Oh, I really like them. And I think if you're going to put, you know, Frank Black back into business, so to speak, in law enforcement, where he's not just consulting, that kind of thing, you're going to need to sort of have this hierarchy, this structure around him. And Baldwin, I mean, is great because he's such a obsequious, you know, ass-kissing, ambitious little bastard, pardon my French, you know, such a shitheel. But I mean, he's sort of like in the class of Emma Hollis. You know, they're in the same class together, but obviously they're not the same kind of people. So I really like having that counterpoint with him. I really like that he's, you know, he's so sort of cynical and materialistic and avaricious, ambitious, whatever you want to say. McLaren, I like quite a bit. Now, I haven't gone back and watched every episode of the third season recently. So I can't say, you know, I mean, I like his down home folksiness, but I don't remember if there's a layer beneath that. I mean, but I like the idea that they give Frank a boss who knows him and who doesn't, come across, you know, he's not Kirsch. You know, he's not somebody who's like saying, you know, I literally want you to quit. You know, he's not that kind of character. There's a, he seems to project a decency and humanity in that role. And I haven't watched, you know, I don't remember a lot of specific touches about the character, except he seemed a good choice because we had seen a lot of these types already in the X-Files between Skinner, Kirsch, whoever Cary Elwes was playing at one point.
Brad Fulmer.
Okay, right. So you know, we're after a while, one boss starts to look a lot like another boss. So I like that he, with his dialect, his sort of friendship with Frank, that he's a little different from the ones we've seen before, because at this point that couldn't have been easy to do.
Yeah.
In their creative hair. How do we carve out a spot for this person so he's not just a Skinner knockoff or a Kirsch knockoff? And I think they did a pretty good job with that.
Yeah. There's elements of him in certain episodes which they're a bit wishy-washy, and I would have liked to have had him a bit stronger. But I think it's going to be interesting going into the rest of the episode, because I really do like him. I think he was in the first episode, the camaraderie and that making Frank smile was a good way of bringing him in. But at the same time, you know, he is a boss at the end of the day. So I think he worked really well in The Innocence and Exegesis. But there's episodes later on or around this time where they haven't quite figured him out yet. But he does, right. but he does work in general. And he's also, and Stephen Miller's actually joined the Facebook group as well, which was nice to see. So, he's actually joined the group. So hopefully he's listening in. So thank you very much, Stephen, for your portrayal. So the only thing I've got to mention, is there anything you want to mention other than that then on the episode itself?
I just want to say, you know, I want to read those journals. I want to see the names on every one of Ed's journals, and I want to know what's in them. I know obviously it's a fictional world, but to me that's like a really good episode when it says, like, here's an alternative reading of history, and it's all out in public view, and it's in, you know, how many volumes. So whenever I watch this episode, I always think, and I know they obviously didn't make them, but yeah, I think. Oh my gosh, I would love to sit down in that chair like Frank did. And I would love to have that pile of books. And I would love to have, you know, this history going 15 years back to this time. And see, to me, that was a fascinating into the episode itself. Yeah. This idea of there being an alternate history running right along, you know, with the history we see. I just think that's a terrific idea. And the idea that this guy's insight comes through writing. And that's also his madness. The writing is his insight, and it's also his madness. I liked that, the two sides of the coin there. So I thought that was a great way to present this character.
Okay, well Paul Terry's just done a book on the X-Files with you know, case files or such, a bit similar to the history of Twin Peaks, that kind of aspect. So we've Carl Sweeney just interviewed him recently, so maybe we should put that to him and say, you know, he's an option for you, another 10-13 option. It's slightly right. Slightly a bit more nuanced than the one you've just done, but that'll be great to see. The only thing I've got on for the rest of the episode is the reoccurrence of the eye, which we saw on the Innocence and Exegesis, that appears on the wall on the just outside Ed's apartment where the original crime was committed. And I think there was, and the fact that Frank, again, it's another thing that kind of reminded me of the pilot, was the chase after Ed as well. That felt very much like it almost brought me back to the pilot, because it's not something you see Frank do a lot of. So I don't know if you've got any comment on the use of eyes, Chris, at this moment. I mean, no doubt we'll touch upon it later on in the season.
I just, again, it's a cool symbol. and it has sort of a mystique to it, and kind of lends that, you know, that Frank can see things that people can't. Has that vibe to it.
Right. Okay. So let's call this episode a wrap. We just need to go into the mailbag, and we should do that now to see what the people on Twitter and Facebook have been saying. Right. Okay. So on Facebook, that's not too many of these. Just a couple of messages. So on Facebook, Christian Pond says various milestones. Peter returns. The group returns, and now they are villains without a doubt. Peter, courtship of Emma begins. Like we've gone through, a light of hope in a season that did not start in the best way. Bunny Lake says, great episode. And on Twitter, we've got Paige Schechter, who's just recorded with me for a future episode. She says, a key episode of the season, fabulous performance by Mr. Gross, with an important development for Emma. The scene with Hollis and Peter Watts was well thought out and a perfect way of moving the story forward, even though the concept of the Millennium Group has been reconfigured. And Oscar Groucho, returning commenter, says, an absolute fundamental episode in a rough period for Millennium. A superb guest turned by Gross, coupled with the most successful marriage of Duggan's procedure and Johannesson's dreamlike opaque imagery. A superb installment that sets the tenor of the season out deftly. So, yeah, I mean, I think we touched upon it ever so slightly, but throughout Duggan's and John Johannesson's episodes so far, I don't know if you can really call this, and John, but not seen too many episodes of late, but that the amalgamation of the two together, I know that what did you make to the whole Duggan procedural kind of Johannesson's join, and obviously it doesn't last very long. What did you make to that?
Well, I hate to say it. I'm not sure what were the other episodes they worked on together.
Well, right? Basically, Duggan did the first like seven episodes before he left, and then he got handed over to Ken Horton. So Ken Horton wrote this episode itself, but Duggan was still in charge at this point. And obviously, the first few episodes it had Johannesson's kind of aspect, you know, with Chris and I mentioned in, I think it must be Exegesis, where it's almost the identical start of Force Majeure, and Chris Johannesson's very much like a dream-esque kind of dreamlike quality kind of writer. But then, you know, then we've got I can't remember his name now, Duggan coming back from a Law and Order kind of background, so that this mixture of this dreamlike quality, like we get at the beginning of this episode, and the kind of procedural elements that are written within it.
Well, I think that is kind of, I mean, if you're looking for something that Millennium embodies, and I think Chris spoke about this at the beginning of this episode, is that they, like, people have a different perception of what Millennium is or supposed to be. But at its core, whether you're watching first season, second season, or third season, what we're looking at is a police procedural that leads us into some sort of dreamlike / nightmarish / surreal experience. So any creative combination that can capture that magic, I think that is what the core of Millennium is, as wide as that sounds. But I think when you get into the last six or seven episodes of Millennium in the third season, we get so baroque, so bizarre. We're even doubling down on the surreal, bizarre imagery and dreamlike qualities. We talk about Saturn dreaming of Mercury, Bardo et al., 7 and 1. Those episodes, I mean, you have to watch those and really think, like, what the heck is going on here? But I mean, I think there are answers to be excavated there. But I mean, it's like doubling down on that dreamlike surreal quality. But I mean, again, if you're talking about what is Millennium, it's a police procedural where the answers come not from necessarily criminal behavior, but from this kind of imagery and narrative where we're, you know, I mean, look, going back to the other episode, look at Beware the Dog. I mean, oh my gosh, what, that is a crazy episode that borders on parody, surreal. I mean, you know, that's how Millennium got to do what it was going to do. I always say Millennium it's like Star Trek, but the crimes are the different planets you visit every week. You know, those crimes, when seen through this lens of the surreal or nightmare or dreamscape, whatever, that's the meat of Millennium. So I mean, I've always thought the third season of Millennium is actually pretty great. Now, if you were going to say to me, do I like the first part of the season or last part of the season better, and were I to break it down into teams, I don't know that I'd be prepared to do that right now, not having engaged in a, you know, complete rewatch. I did rewatch this episode in preparation for today, you know, and I reread some of the stuff I've written in the past to see, you know, trying to connect it and stuff. But like that, I don't know that I can specifically answer. I hate to cop out. But.
No, I don't think it's a cop out. I would agree. I think you've got to take it as a piece. There was this issue at the beginning, and there was obviously various aspects. But it is interesting with you saying that. That's something that'll be in the back of my mind now. That, as you say, when you get to seven and one and Bardo, Fordo, and all those episodes, that, you know, it's Chip Johansson's got a bit more hands on the wheels than he did have at the beginning. It's almost like it's a bit more restrained at the beginning. So it seems, you know, it would be interesting. It's like the Carter-Spotnitz kind of relationship. And I think that going through the season, it will be really interesting to see how that develops once Duggan does leave. And then we get episodes like The Sound of Snow, for example, you know, so things like that, which become more surreal and more dreamlike. And, you know, we're only starting the journey. So it should be really interesting to do that. Chris, any final thoughts on that comment then on the kind of Johannesson Duggan sort of stuff and the dreamlike logic through the season?
Well, I got to tell you, like at this point in my life, I only care about, like, you know, surreal dreamlike narratives. I'm just so tired of like watching people pretend to be other people at this point. You know, it seems so pointless, you know, especially with all the, you know, video, thousands of video being posted a second on YouTube or whatever, people doing real things. So what I think that the next frontier for television and film is to sort of, you know, take things further in that surreal direction. Unfortunately, it's something, it's very difficult to do right. I think that they did it right here. And, you know, like my favorite episodes this season, are the, like the Satin Dreaming of Mercury and the Sound of Snow and that kind of thing. I just love that again, that like, you don't know what's going on. You, the ground beneath you, it might not actually be there. It's just, you know, that dreamlike, fungible shifting reality is really exciting to me, and it's something that I really wish they pursued a little bit more enthusiastically, especially since they were at a point in the series where it didn't matter anymore. Everybody knew that this was it, and it had only kind of been renewed because Fox didn't have anything to put in that slot, right? But there's a Omerta. You know, I mean, that's sort of the extreme end of this. But, you know, that's got a real charm to it. And it's sort of like taking that Darren Morgan thing, but, you know, not Darren Morgan, Morganing it, you know, going in a different direction. But, I do love that surreal feeling. And I hope to see more of that done well. And like I said, though, it's very hard to do well.
Right. Well, that calls the episode to an end. And this is your final episode on the main episodes, John. So I just want to thank you for being on all three seasons in some point. We do have a potential episode that you may be coming on in the future, which we have marked down. So that'll be great. But this will be your final one for the actual season. So thank you very much, I guess, I say for coming on. Where can people find you online, and what things are you up to, post this pandemic? And I know you were mentioning about your books before last time we spoke, but where about are you, and what are you up to?
Well, I'm about a month away from my deadline on horror films of the 2000s, which is my fourth big survey book of decades, having done the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I'm also rebroadcasting on YouTube the episodes of my 2007 to 2009, you know, no budget web series, The House Between. And I think at some point we may be able to announce that is maybe coming back as an audio drama or something like that. But the details are still being worked out. I'm still blogging. I still do my blog at Reflections on Film and Television. And that's about it.
Excellent stuff. Again, thank you very much, John. It's been a pleasure to have you on all three seasons. It's been much appreciated, and always being great to have you on and to talk Millennium, which is great. Chris, you don't get away that easily. you'll be back.
Yeah, so. I want to put in a plug for my book, He Will Live Up in the Sky, my first novel, and anybody who's a 1013 fan is going to love it.
Right, okay. So yes, Chris, you will be back later on. Your next episode that's going to come out with you on is Collateral Damage.
Oh boy, very exciting!
Yes, that is very exciting. You know, obviously with a Buffy Illuminati in that episode.
Yes.
So that'll be the next episode that you see you. But for people who want to see what I'm up to, you can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. It's rmuldrake. I'm currently running the XCast as well now with Sarah and Carl. So come and find us over at the X_cast and also on the Red Dwarf podcast, which is Shipwrecked and Comatose. And you can find us on Twitter there at Red Dwarf Pod as well. And there may be a new little venture that we're doing as well, but we're not quite ready to announce that yet. So thank you everyone for coming on. It's been a great pleasure. And until next time, remember, this is who we are.
Elsewhere, and We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, because we were talking about this. We've talked about the different covers there are. Now, you yourself, I thought I'd found a nice little sort of hidden gem here, because you yourself were in a band called Bleeder, or still are in a band called Bleeder.
Yeah.
And when I was looking on Spotify just for different covers of the song, I noticed there is a cover of this by a band called Bleeder, and I was like, "Oh, brilliant! This is what Niall's not told me, is that he's actually done a cover of it that got released."
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Maybe I'm not coming at it from an educated point of view, because, you know, not only am I a man, I'm gay. You know, I don't deal with pregnancy.
Are you?
And,
and have you ever told us that before?
I was trying to make a serious point.
Hey, we love you, you know that.
Yeah. But yeah, you have got a good point, Colin. This is a bit of a sausage fest episode. Maybe we should have got a lady involved.
Real Asian Podcast.
You know, so I really do feel that there's this... and whether it's an invisible weight on our shoulders to be able to be like this ideal child, or like, you know, just being able to not drag the family name down for whatever reason, even if it's self-imposed.
Even if it's just completely made up in your mind.
Right. Like, you know, Brian, you were just saying about your friend who said they felt like they couldn't come out to you.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod, or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.